18 seconds, brother.
Get him, Mighty Hubs. Hubs, 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 Hubs. Look at the Gray Leader report.
Man.
Tell Matt. Would you just tell Matt?
What?
18 seconds, Mike.
Oops, it's not 18 seconds. It was Matt, I'm still hearing that noise.
It's not me.
Oh, no.
Just in five.
Oh, great.
Four.
This is really bad.
Three, two, one. We're live.
Alley-oop.
This is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian bunker. You know what time it is. Welcome one and all from around the globe, wherever you are, to the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, about to lead you across the River Styx and on into the fringe, the darkness that is the twilight world of Fortiana. Joining me in studio, as always, is the Graylian Reverend. We have to have a holy man to keep things right here in the eternal night that is the hollow earth. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, and I'm glad it's me.
Yeah, I'm glad it's you, too. Otherwise, I might be saying Eve to someone else, like our fine friends at Gaia. Don't forget about them, by the way. Check them out, Gaia.com. Our proud sponsors of this program. So, lots to get into tonight as we look ahead, and one of my very favorite subjects, the hidden powers of the human mind. You know, some speculate that there is such a thing as what the famous detective Sherlock Holmes called a mind palace. And we're going to look at that and people who have incredible abilities that include memory, recall, and other kinds of strange things that maybe the average Joe doesn't have. But the question on my mind, can it be something that is developed? Can the average Joe learn to do these things? Could you, in other words, become a mastermind like that great detective? I aspire to do it. Many of you out there do too, I'm sure. Hence why you listen to a program like this every week. Glad to have you guys on board. Oh, of course, yes. And the man back in master control. The bow. The face of bow. A bow, that is. How you doing, Hobbs?
I'm doing wonderful. Wonderful for a Monday.
Yeah, exactly. Wonderful for a Monday. If you follow me on Twitter, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you saw this, Hobbs. I put this picture out. Matt saw it. I said, you know, Mondays are always crazy for me, but this one was like an atom bomb of crazy, and it's this hilarious, like, you know, mushroom cloud turning into a clown face. That one goes out to all the creepy clowns out there.
Yeah, especially Stephen King's It.
I was about to say, we may have gotten rid of the creepy clowns once and for all, but everybody keeps talking to me about Stephen King's It.
Have you seen the trailer?
Well, that's my next question. But I haven't yet. No, I've been too busy to watch trailers. Is that on, like, oh, I don't know, Apple trailers or something?
Oh, I'm sure it's everywhere. It's a great trailer, though. It looks really frightening and good, and King himself has said it's a great rendition of the book.
Yeah, well, the book was pretty weird. Weirder than the film. I won't go into details, but anyway, I don't know. A lot of us, we've had enough of the creepy clown thing, at least for a while. So I'm going to let that sleeping dog lie. That sleeping hellhound of the Baskervilles, or as we say, of Mr. Bruton. That is my good pal, McNonymous. He has a dog, you know, down there. We call him Bruton, the hound of the Jacksonvilles. That's pretty good. So, Matt, what's going on in your world, apart from watching movie trailers? I know you're really excited about Ghost in the Shell as well.
Well, I'm interested to see it. You know, I was a big fan of the original movie when I was a lot younger and saw that. But, you know, it's the reviews are real hit and miss with it. But I think it's got a real a Graylian ring to it. You know, a human mind and a robot body, and then terrorists hacking into our minds and being able to control us, that kind of thing.
You know, that is something I want to get into a little later as time allows, because I've got two AI stories. Unfortunately, I can't do a whole AI segment. They're going to have to kind of, you know, fall as they may throughout the program. By the way, we've got a new interface over there at kgraradio.com. It's no longer forward chat room. It's forward chat. And there at the kgraradio.com/chat, you'll forward slash, by the way. Okay. Everybody speaks internet here, right? Okay, yeah. We're good. Yeah, so that's where the chat interface, I can't really call it a chat room anymore, but the chat interface can be found there. Matt is moderating. I've got to figure out how to disable the sounds, otherwise I'd be in there. But hello to all you chatters out there who I'm not able to see.
Well, you know, we've upgraded from a room to a lounge, it looks like.
Yeah, a room to a lounge. I mean, so far on this trip, I've been in a train, in a car, and a room, and a room, and a room, and a room.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just I'm wondering what I'm going to see next.
All over the place.
I am all over the place. Hobbs, I hope everything's sweet and sunny up there in Arkansas.
Well, it started out rainy this morning, my son and I, up at 5 o'clock. Back to the fishing hole we went. We filled up another cooler in about an hour and a half, and it took us, I was just put it in the chat room, it actually took us longer to clean the fish than it did to catch them. But it was, it's cleared up, and it's just a little bit breezy out there. The wind is, there's 50 mile an hour gusts out there today.
I got to ask, was that a metaphor for how hard it was raining, or did you guys really go fishing?
No, we really went fishing.
Because, listen, sometimes the way that you talk, Race, I was telling my buddy Kyle Filson the other night on the telephone of Expanded Perspectives. I said, Hobbo is the best storyteller, perhaps, that I know. And the way that you phrase things, you have your own distinct lingo, which people say that they have a hard time occasionally acclimating to my own accent. I've had people who write in and they say, I've had to listen for years to really be able to pick up all the nuances of things that you say. Now, those people are probably the ones that say I sound Southern. But then in the sweet, sunny South, I'll walk into a bar, and 9 times out of 10, Matt has witnessed this. People say what? What do they always say I sound like?
You sound like a Brit.
Yeah, they say, are you from England? Then you're from Australia, right? And I'm like, wow, do I really sound that weird and a-regional?
And then you go over there, and you sound like Elvis.
Yes, when I'm in England, they'll say, you remind me a lot of Elvis. You sound like Elvis. Yeah. And then, of course, somebody wrote into me the other night from Mississippi and said, by the way, Micah, you don't sound anything like Elvis. Well, actually, I guess he was born in Tupelo, right? But he spent more of his time in Memphis. So from Mississippi to Memphis, wherever you may be, yeah, the people in that region, they probably don't think I sound that much like him. Hey, listen, let me just get one thing off my chest. If there's one thing I hate, and you know, I won't lie, I've been lying in there in my study on the smoking lounge, staring idly at the ceiling, occasionally reaching over for the briar pipe the last few days. Maybe it's the weather. Maybe it was the aliens. Must have been the aliens, right, Cowboy Matt? But anyway, but in truth, the thing is, to me, when you're a little down on the dumps, it doesn't help when you wake up to news like what we saw in Russia today. And so regarding those bombings that we heard about, listen, I speak for me, and I'm sure for Hobbo and for Mr. Oakley, especially being a reverend. I think all of us here at the Gray Alien Report would just like to say our hearts go out to those who have been affected by these acts of terror, frankly, acts of cowardice. And despite the political tensions that many of us are feeling right now between East and West, I think that an act like this makes it ever more clear how important it is that we, as an international community, as Team Humanity, if you want to call it that, how important it is that we move, that we must move forward and do that together in promotion of unity and solidarity against those and the actions that would seek to attack and kill innocent people. That is something that I think no matter where you live in the world, if you stand for the rule of law and for justice, that's not something we tolerate. So our hearts go out to people in Russia who have been affected by this. And with that, all darkness aside, we'll talk a little bit about dark energy, because right now physicists from Loran University in Hungary and the Institute of Astronomy at the University of Hawaii are now asking the big question about dark energy. One, in fact, that a lot of people have been asking. They're questioning whether some of Einstein's equations actually introduced what are referred to by these physicists in this study as serious side effects that gave the illusion of a vast unknown force pushing space apart rather than a reality. That's right, we're talking about dark energy here. Now, if it exists, dark energy would, according to the current model, it would make up about 68% of the energy in the observable universe, but at just 10 to 27 kilograms per square meter, it would be incredibly hard to spot in a laboratory. And thus far, that's, well, been the case. We haven't really been able to find any real conclusive evidence that suggests that this is indeed something that is part of the material structure, or immaterial, depending on how you look at it, of our universe. Now, ever since the late 1990s, In this report by Science Alert, physicists have been fairly certain that the universe isn't only getting bigger, it also appears to be expanding at an ever-increasing rate. And in addition to the question of acceleration, dark energy also helps explain things like the overall shape of the universe and the pattern of matter that we see rippling through space. But the thing is, you see, right now it's a little more than an empty box without any other properties to describe the nature of its existence. In fact, it's currently assumed to be a fundamental part of empty space, and this, in broader context, is referred to as the cosmological constant. Okay, there's like a little Greek letter that they use to reference that, but we won't get into all that right now. Now, back in the early 20th century, remember old Einstein proposed the cosmological constant, right? And he had put forth at that time that there was this idea, a kind of fudge factor, if you want to call it that, to explain why all the mass scattered throughout the universe was not pulling back together under the attraction of its own gravity. We couldn't figure this out. And when Edwin Hubble made it clear that the universe wasn't just resisting collapse, but actually was expanding, well, then the cosmological constant was thrown in the bin. And that's one of the most interesting periods in history for me, because in the aftermath of what Einstein, with his multiple revelations through relativity, and keep in mind about that, he didn't say, well, this is going to be the be-all, end-all, I have rewritten physics, and now all bow before me, ye intellectually inferior. No, he said, you know, I thought that this would be one addition to the broader physics that we understand, you know, our fuller understanding of the universe. And I thought that eventually, like, again, Isaac Newton's Newtonian physics and the Principia, he thought that that would be replaced, relativity, just as Newton's laws, to an extent, were updated and replaced. See, Newtonian physics works to a point, and many would argue that Einstein's relativity works to a point, although it is a better model that explains simply a wide range of different phenomena observable in the universe. And time again, Einstein's relativity has been testable. That's the thing. But it's now known that the universe appeared to grow again. Coming back to Edwin Hubble, rather, and what he did when he was observing the fact that, again, the universe is actually expanding. You see, it's now known that the universe appeared to grow at a slower rate in its youth than it does today, making the cosmological constant useful again as a way to explain this apparent increase in speed over time. So you put together with another hypothetical black box factor, dark matter. Okay, not to be confused with dark energy. Do you remember years ago, by the way, Matt, when I made that fundamental error on this program, I mistook dark matter for dark energy and vice versa. And boy, did the listeners let me know. I've come a long way since those days, okay?
I'm just glad we have listeners of that caliber that can point that out.
A lot of listeners in the scientific community. Yeah, a lot of them. My lab buddy, in fact, who I haven't been in touch with in weeks, but yeah, indeed. There's been a whole different kind of dark matter, I'm sure, on some of my my friends in the minds of my friends in the scientific community, but that's a whole different matter. Now, again, dark matter, which would comprise of a further 27% of the known universe. Okay, that's what we're talking about here. And you put that together with what we're already discussing, and we get the lambda cold dark matter. Okay. Actually, it's lambda, I think. In other words, long story short, it's just a model that explains how the universe evolved. Okay, it combines both elements. Now, while Einstein's general relativity was responsible for laying much of the groundwork for this model, the mathematics isn't always so easy to apply. Okay, prompting physicists to crunch parts of its own model down using educated assumptions, or, well, I guess you might kind of call those hypotheses. And I'll say this about that, by the way. If you really know math, and our mathematicians out there in the audience will be able to affirm this, if you really know math, math and numbers and equations do not always provide a perfect corollary for what we observe in reality. The physical world does not always have a direct mirror that can be expressed equationally. We often come very close, but I mean, a very simple example of what we're talking about. We've discussed this, and we've had listeners write in the past about this. You say 99.99% of the time, but again, a mathematician would say, although you and I would say that's not 100, but a mathematician would say, but you know, functionally and technically, in fact, that is just 100%. And you know, there are a lot of little things. Again, I always talk about that book that I love so much, How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking by Jordan Ellenberg. If you really didn't think that you would find math interesting, get a copy of that book, and you may prove yourself wrong. I do find math interesting, and therefore I love that book, but it's a great book on a lot of the ways that, you know, math and the physical reality that we exist within, they don't really mirror each other in all cases. So again, you know, the physicists involved in this current research, they're looking right now for a number of things. And these researchers argue that approximations that they've used, these educated assumptions, have ignored potentially significant influences of large-scale structures within our universe. And if it were possible to step outside of our universe for a moment, open your minds with me, ladies and gents. Let's try to think outside that box, the box universe, that is. If it were possible to step outside the universe for a moment and look down upon it, there would be threads of galaxies, and we would call these superclusters, and they would be lining what look like relatively empty spaces that abound. But according to the physicists involved in this new research we're talking about, okay, the large-scale structures, these bubbles of seemingly empty space and the galaxies surrounding them, literally cause matter to expand around us so quickly that I have to chase my microphone sometimes, Matthew.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah. They would create zones where expansion occurs at different rates, almost like mini universes. These issues were previously swept under the rug, but now, again, Laszlo Dobos, one of the researchers involved with this study, he was quoted saying, again, that while previously swept under the rug, we now are taking them into account, and we're now maybe seeing that these can explain the acceleration of the universe as it expands without the need for dark energy at all. I'll tell you, you give them another decade, and we may have a whole different understanding of physics from what we know. I mean, there will always be elements that we maintain from what we've learned. We didn't completely throw Newtonian physics out the window because, you know, within a smaller range of observable phenomena, that still works. So does relativity. I maintain it probably will continue. But as we continue to sharpen our focus and enhance and zoom in and enhance and zoom in deeper and deeper and deeper, and darker and darker and darker, it may not be so dark after all. In fact, finally, we may see the light of truth, and there may not be dark energy as we once thought. I'll tell you, somebody who loves to talk about this, Matt. Neil deGrasse Tyson, your best pal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Matt really wants to interview him when he comes.
I do.
He's coming to Asheville.
I need to get my tickets. I may be able to get
you a ticket. Yes.
Hey, we should talk later offline.
Asheville Graylian fan number one. You know who you are. Let's get this guy a ticket. But Neil was in the news recently. Apparently, he has decided to pass on an opportunity to take a trip to Mars. That is, unless, of course, CEO and founder Elon Musk can send him back home. Remember, the current Mars colonization project, it's a one-way trip.
Yeah.
Neil said he wouldn't do it. He said,
not unless Musk was able to send Musk's mother there and back first, and then he'd consider taking the trip.
So what's he implying there?
He's like, if you're going to take that much care, obviously you'd take that much care of your mother.
Oh, I see.
So if you could prove it that way, I'll be happy to join in. I saw the snippets of the interview and stuff. It's hilarious.
Oh, did you really? You got to get sound bites. That's okay. Well, I can tell you what he said.
I meant on the actual articles and things like that. I actually
So when you read it, did you hear it in his voice?
Oh, yes.
Though? You know,
yeah,
people
absolutely.
Who listen to this podcast, they tell me, they say, I read your tweets in your voice. Isn't that weird? Not really, actually. It's quite charming. Thank you. But I'm going to try and read this for you in Neil deGrasse Tyson's voice.
Oh, please do.
Here we go. I really like Earth. I don't do a good one.
No, that's awful.
Shut up. Look, there you go. I hadn't had to do that in a long time.
That's right.
Had to launch a pin at Matt Oakley. So he says, so any space trip I take, I'm double checking that there's sufficient funds for me to return. Also, I'm not taking that trip until Elon Musk sends his mother and brings her back alive. Then I'm good for it. So there you go. Matt already once again broke the news before the punchline arrived. Hey, would you do a favor for me? Would you get my pen? I need that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Should I throw it back at you?
That's not my pen. I want my pen. Get my pen. Thank you. Well, I can't blame him. You know, if I hand it here, I need that pen. Thank you. It's important to be able to have your pen, ladies and gentlemen, when you're live on the radio.
Yeah, exactly. Stop throwing it.
So they just wanted to know, you know, what Neil thought about SpaceX and their Falcon 9 relaunch. You know, this is really groundbreaking stuff because we're getting into an era of reliably reusable rocketry, which is going to cheapen the cost of space travel. And, of course, this, I believe, again, coming from Mr. Tyson, any demonstration of rocket reusability is a good thing. When we fly on a Boeing 747 across great distances, we didn't throw it away and roll out a new one. Good point. Reusability is arguably the most fundamental feature of affordable, expensive things. Yeah. So those are some of the things on his mind right now as it comes down to space travel. But again, I can't really blame Neil for not wanting to take that great leap. It is an awful lot of us to have to ask that for the future of humanity, I mean, this is almost like what we see in Interstellar. For the future of humanity, we're going to have to send some people out there to do what no person has ever done before, and they may not get to come back. You may have to go out there and start. See, here's the thing. What's worse, though? This is the difference between what you see in film and what you see in real life. In Interstellar, it was all a big conspiracy. There was no plan. There was no exit strategy. They were going to get sent out there, and they were going to get marooned on a planet, right? And they, the astronauts, didn't know it. Otherwise, why would they go? Well, in real life, unfortunately, we don't have to do that. Well, actually, it's very fortunate that we don't have to do that. We can actually tell people, guess what? We need you guys to go out there and start Earth-Base 1 on another planet. But here's the catch. You don't get to come back. And people are actually willing to do it.
I mean, that's one of those things where, really, how could you be kind of subversive in that point? Like, yeah, it's important, but this is kind of a big thing. This isn't just being like, well, it's going to be 3 months instead of one. We forgot to tell you. This is permanent. You know?
I'll tell you how you could be subversive. Here's how that would work. I figured it out. Only in the event that there was a secret space program, which actually in Interstellar, that's what's happening. There is a secret space program, and therefore they're able to keep it off the books. But something that's so widely publicized as the operations of NASA or SpaceX, again, whether it's a government-funded space program or private enterprise funding it, again, yeah, we don't have that kind of subversiveness. And therefore, I think that once again, we find that reality is actually a little better than what we see going on in the films. But the films do raise good questions. There are good questions, I think, that we ask about ourselves. You know, whether it's like Ghost in the Shell, and it has to do with artificial intelligence. And I think that one of the big questions about AI really has less to do with artificial intelligence. And I think it has a lot more to do with what role humanity will play in the future. And indeed, if we are to be outperformed by machines, how do humans find our sense of purpose? That's a big question. You know, there are times, I think, in life where we all wonder if there is something more for us out there and what precisely we are being called to do, you know, helping and educating others, separating facts from falsehoods in this era of fake news, you know, joining together with others in our communities. And you got to keep in mind, those communities don't have to be at home or in your neighborhood. I mean, they could also exist on the World Wide Web, the people there in the chat room. And I got to tell you, too, at Gaia, the search for ourselves and our deeper purpose is also at the heart of what they do. Regina Meredith is one of their hosts, and she really features this kind of content a lot in her program. It's called Open Minds. And I find Meredith being someone who, like so many of us, has been on her own personal quest. You know, she's been in search of humanity's higher purpose. I have been in search of my higher purpose. I think that as we all aspire to grow and learn and change and better ourselves, we all try to do that, right? And Regina seems to really believe that many of us, both individually and collectively, are kind of beginning to feel this purpose. Do you guys feel that out there? Matt, do you feel something changing? Do you feel some sort of a deepened purpose?
Perhaps in some aspects of my life.
I kind of do also. Some people would call it a purpose. Some would call it a true calling. You know, I often try to drive home the point that if we're going to try and find our true calling, make sure that what we do together. Make it one of unity, especially during these times where so many are desperate for change. And you know, I feel confident in saying that Regina is not alone, because at Gaia, you know, you'll find a lot of information. Gaia offers some of the most up-to-date information, in fact, on the esoteric and the downright inspiring from a variety of great hosts that include Sean Stone with his Buzzsaw program, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief with our pal George Norrie, Missing Links, a lot of great shows. And so do check them out. It's Gaia.com. That's Gaia.com/Graylian. That's Gaia.com/Graylian. Do that now. If you're near your computer, if not, write it down, bookmark it, whatever you have to do, come back, check it out. It will be worth your time, because I think in these times, we all have a lot of questions. I know I do. And there are a variety of ways that you can find answers. One of those, of course, is listening to this show. One more reason we appreciate what Gaia does, helps keeping us on the air an easy thing and a fun thing every week as we take you guys through space time from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time. Every week, it is the Graylian Report. I shall return with Mr. Oakley here in a moment.
Yeah.
From the high mountains of Appalachia, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe, on the internet. Glad to bring my astonishing radio presence here to KGRARadio.com. Baby, I think the Oak and I know a little bit about how to do live radio, okay? It's important, in fact. We've been doing it for a long time. If we didn't know by now, we wouldn't be worth anything. So, hey, at least we're worth something. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, great. Now that we got that behind us, we did our Crypto Corner thing last week. Remember that, Matt? I got some interesting news and an update on that. Right now, however, and this is one of the big stories of the day, a scientist is now saying he believes he can use DNA to test the waters of Loch Ness in a new bid to determine once and for all if Nessie exists. Now, you'll remember, of course, that Brian Sykes, that's not who's in charge of this DNA study, but Brian Sykes, a couple of years ago, had done a similar kind of a thing. He had used DNA to try and prove the existence of Bigfoot. And at that time, their study revealed what Sykes believed may be evidence of a new undiscovered species of bear, but no Bigfoot. Later, additional studies said, well, we don't think there's even, you know, a mystery bear out there. So that's science. And while, again, I'd mentioned that P.Z. Myers and a few other in the, you know, the further down the rabbit hole skeptic side of things had said, well, this is just absurd that this guy would waste his time trying to do this. There have been other skeptics, Sharon Hill, we've got Brian Dunning. Of course, I'll always say that it's important that scientists do this. But, I mean, there were some people who were saying, hey, look, it's good when scientists try to put, science behind cryptozoology rather than just leaving it up to the weekend warriors. What a novel idea that we actually have scientists paying attention to unexplained mysteries rather than just dismissing them out of hand. Just amazing idea. Whoa. Yeah, exactly.
I liked your spirit hands just then.
I had to do spirit hands because it's so ridiculous to me that people think that it's scientifically of sound mind to dismiss out of hand something for which, even if there's only anecdotal evidence, if enough people say, hey, look, we saw something, that is not something that science seeks to address. Well, so Brian Sykes did it. Found no evidence of Bigfoot, but did some good science along the way, still got castigated. What does that tell you about our scientific mind these days? And I don't want to point the finger, guys, with many in the scientific community out there in our listenership who correspond with me on a weekly basis. I'm not pointing the finger at you. I'm pointing the finger at people who think that science is about dismissal, not about asking the right questions and then performing good science, like Professor Neil Gemmell hopefully plans to do when he, and here's the plan, he wants to look for traces of unusual DNA by gathering water samples from the Scottish Loch before analyzing them using police forensic techniques. Now, first question. Why has nobody ever done this before? Oh, probably because they didn't believe that there could be a creature. And, you know, again, in likelihood, there probably isn't. When I was younger, I used to really kind of hope that there was a Loch Ness monster. Well, it seems a little less likely these days. But either way you want to look at it, Professor Gemmell of New Zealand's University of Otago thinks that this could solve the monster mystery. And he said, we use environmental DNA to monitor marine biodiversity. And therefore, from a few liters of water, we can detect thousands of species. And he says, all large organisms lose cells as they move through their environment. New genomic technology is sensitive enough to pick this up, and we can use comparisons of databases that span the majority of known living things. So if there was anything unusual in the lock, these DNA tools would be likely to pick up that evidence. So that's pretty neat. I mean, I think that's great. Now, it was reported recently in the Daily Mail, they talked about this, and of course, Roland Watson, he's one of the well-known Nessie researchers in the area. He said he was not aware of anyone, again, having done a DNA test like this before, but added there are some monster supporters that would not care about the result because they believe it is something paranormal and so wouldn't expect to see any DNA. I think Nick Redfern wrote a book that looked at the paranormal side of Loch Ness. And you know, Nick, he knows that I disagree with him about this, so there's no animosity whatsoever. I mean, we sat side by side in a studio and had these kind of discussions. But for me personally, I don't go so far as to say that, well, Nessie could be the ghost of a dinosaur. And, you know, again, that's not really the crux of what Nick says, but this is one of these kind of paranormal ideas that's been put forward over the years. And Nick wrote a whole book that kind of examined some of those theories. In fact, he had even suggested to me at one point, he said, you know, why don't you look at that sort of an idea with regard to certain other cryptids? And I said, well, I have to, you know, step back and say, before we can attribute the mysteries of cryptozoology to some paranormal phenomena, I think we first have to rule out whether they are indeed physical creatures. Okay? Like, for instance, what's going on, and we reported this last week with the Tasmanian tiger, okay? The thylacine, believed to have been extinct for years. But recently, of course, we reported on scientists in Queensland, Australia, who are taking action in hopes of actually finding evidence that maybe these things still exist due to, and this is interesting, the number of sightings. Now, what's different from a Tasmanian tiger sighting and a Nessie or a Bigfoot sighting? Well, the Tasmanian tiger isn't a mystery creature believed to maybe possibly exist, according to whispers in the night. No, and this is a creature that did exist. And although it is believed extinct, people claim they still see them. And so scientists are saying, hey, look, you know what? We got to start taking some of these claims seriously. But if there's anything to be made about the other cryptids, perhaps those which may resemble something that has existed in the ancient past, you can't say that there haven't been, according to popular descriptions of the Loch Ness Monster, that there haven't been things in the past that sort of resemble that that existed. Maybe, I mean, millions of years ago, but hey, they were here. You could say the same thing about Bigfoot. Bigfoot looks an awful lot like a large, feral human covered in hair. Not completely outside the realm of possibility for something that could exist, but in recent times, in modern times, and especially in terms of there being any kind of a fossil record, there's no evidence that supports the existence of those creatures. So I get it, why it's more difficult for science to say, well, okay, those guys, you know, we're not going to really put a whole lot of time into looking for creatures that are far less likely to exist than something that was known to exist. We've even got film and plenty of photographs of thylacines, and people say that they're still seeing them. And if confirmed, again, you know, it would be a monumental discovery. It really would. But, you know, I'll just give you an idea of some of the other extinct species that have turned up. Matt, this is, I think, your favorite. The Philippine naked-backed fruit bat.
Absolutely. How'd you know that was my favorite?
Well, because I'm a mastermind. I had to go into my mind palace for a moment to be able to discern that information. But, yeah, this is a large flying bat, okay, basically. It used to be abundant in number. That huge piles of its guano, so abundant rather, that the guano, okay, the bat dung, was mined and used as fertilizer. And this species was declared extinct in 1996 after none had been spotted for several decades. I think that the last sighting at that time had been 1964. So they were declared extinct. The extinction of this large bat is blamed on hunting as people hunt it for its meat. The forest where it foraged for fruits were also replaced by sugarcane plantations. 5 years after it was declared extinct, this bat suddenly was rediscovered and taken off the endangered species list. We also have the Australian night parrot. Okay, this was thought to be extinct as the last sighting of a living member of this species was noted in the 1980s. And then lo and behold, about 4 years ago, we had John Young, who declared that he had seen one, was even able to capture photos, and sure enough, it's now confirmed that there is a population of this nocturnal bird that continues to thrive, and now they're, of course, taking efforts to try and protect the species. There's a nonprofit organization called the Bush Heritage Australia Group, and they procured a 56,000 hectare sanctuary to safeguard this bird. You see, that's what I worry about, though, is that now that we know that those are still alive, we're protecting them. Could there be other creatures out there that are critically endangered but not extinct that we don't pay enough attention to that they may actually die out?
Well, there was actually a story just end of last week. I saw it in USA Today, and the headline was the manatees are no longer on the endangered species list, and not everybody's happy about it, because apparently, since they're no longer on the endangered species list, the kind of protections for them are, you know, being kind of in threat of being scaled back.
That is a problem that we always reach when it comes to various kinds of legislation. I mean, again, you can think about that in terms of social welfare programs. You know, once you get beyond a certain point where you qualify for a federal subsidy, well, you don't get the subsidy, and then you're actually paying more. And so once you get just past that line, you are the one who is impacted the worst. I hope that the same doesn't happen for the manatees. Yeah. Else they end up back on the endangered species list, which sadly may be better for them in the long run, because then they would receive the kind of federal protections, right?
Well, this is the kind of stuff that just goes to show that as a species, we are more reactionary than we are proactive about stuff. And something like this happens, it's like, okay, now we need regulations. We need to go nuts with regulations. It's like, we should have been doing this kind of stuff all along.
You're really right, by the way, Matt. That's a really good point. Yes, we are more reactionary. Humans are so reactionary. I think, again, the political climate here in the United States and internationally is good evidence of that. But I digress. Are you familiar with what's called the Raphium pectinatum? Do you know what that is?
No.
This is another, not living fossil, but formerly extinct and now back from the dead species. This, of course, was spotted by naturalist Bob Walton of the Devon Wildlife Trust. And then, of course, we have the Beauvais red colobus monkey. This primate had not been seen since the 1970s, so many experts assumed once again that it was extinct. The species was photographed in 2015 in the newest wildlife reserve in the Republic of Congo, which is called the Intoku Pikonda National Park. There have been stories for years coming out of the Congo about something else. It's much larger. Not often mentioned, like the Loch Ness Monster. This creature, Mokele Mbembe, that name, I guess, in the native Congolese, I think that's well, the pygmies I know would use this terminology. It means to stop the flow of rivers. And according to their cultural heritage, they believe that there is a large creature that's elephant-like, but the way that they describe it is rather than being an elephant with its, you know, head appended to the body, that there's a long neck with a small snake or turtle-like head on the end of that neck. In essence, I mean, what they describe is something that sounds an awful lot like a small brontosaurus-like creature, and it's believed to live in Lake Tele right there in the Congo. And there have been claims from people. There was an explorer named Rory Nugent who got down there in the 1980s, claimed he had gotten into the Congo, claimed he had made it all the way to Lake Tele, claimed he had taken photographs of the creature, but this is in the era before digital cameras, and claimed that, once again, by the time he got back out of the jungle, that the moisture and the heat had just destroyed the film and that he had no evidence. But that didn't stop a Japanese film crew from flying over Lake Tele, and they were filming a documentary about the alleged cryptid that existed there, and lo and behold, they filmed something swimming through the lake, creating this V-shaped wake as it moves through the water. Unfortunately, in that footage, you know, it leaves an awful lot to the imagination. You really can't see much. But the famous experiment that was done was when the missionaries and the explorers would go down there and they'd heard these stories about this creature, they would show them pictures of other kinds of animals. They'd show them a lion. Well, they knew what a lion was, but then they'd show them a bear, a species that wasn't indigenous to that region. And they were like, we don't know what that is. They'd show them a Tyrannosaurus, and they were like, I don't know what that is either, you know?
It makes me think of a Lewis Black stand-up years ago that I heard. And he's talking about the first settlers that came over to America. He says, imagine going through the woods and just going, oh my God! What the hell was that? Let's eat it.
Well,
I mean, you had to, obviously, but it had to be seeing stuff you've never seen before. It has to be.
Well, the point I'm making here, though, is that they show them all these pictures of different things, and certain animals they recognized, which were the animals in their region, and then certain animals they'd never seen before, and they didn't recognize them. When they were shown a picture of a brontosaurus, they go, Mokele Mbembe. They knew exactly what Mokele Mbembe was. And then there was another creature, I think Imile Ntuka, that they referred to also as being a similar creature, but not with a long neck. But yeah, so they definitely say, they said that they could recognize creatures, which, again, when shown pictures of dinosaurs, they knew what those were. And there was a story that way back in the 1950s, a group of the pygmies there had actually captured and killed one of these, Mokele Mbembe. They captured it and speared it, and that they said that at that evening when they actually consumed some of the flesh of this creature that several of the tribesmen got sick, and thereafter they wouldn't eat that creature or kill that which stops the rivers any longer because they thought it was a spirit animal of some sort, a sacred creature, and that killing it was bad luck because it made some of them sick when they tried. So, I mean, that's, you know, the story. Make of it what you will. I realize that is anecdotal. And more over time, I guess the less and less evidence we have of living dinosaurs in the Congo, let alone a plesiosaurus or something like that in Loch Ness. Or a giant hairy ape man stomping around in the Pacific Northwest. But, you know, again, as we see time and time again, we have had instances where creatures known to exist die out, then we find that they still exist. We have creatures like the coelacanth believed to not have existed since prehistoric times, and then they turn up off the Cape of Good Hope. Yeah. There certainly could be other so-called living fossils out there, but we do have to keep an open mind and, yes, apply science to it. More in a moment. We will be right back. We'll be right back. Matthew, my liege, I am on the quest for the Holy Grailian.
It's quite a quest it is.
It is quite a quest, indeed. Let's let the screen guy do his thing. I feel so much better now. Sometimes it's therapeutic just to let it all out. Okay, so getting back to the news, I've got a story I'm trying to find here. Why do they always do that? They always start texting you when you're live on the air or calling you. Disable the phone lines, Matthew. Batten down the hatches, boy. We're diving deep. Make sure that you've scrubbed your fingerprints, or if you can't do that, you could, of course, use those little wax appendages so that they won't be able to read your stuff.
Sandpaper, I thought, was the preferred method, right?
Yes. Yes, it was. Okay, so now, where were we here? I wanted to talk a little bit about archaeology right now, and I've got three stories. I'm going to have to skip ahead to the last one here. According to the Hebrew Bible, many of you will know this story. Matt and I did a segment about ritual, tradition, religiousness, all this kind of stuff on the Grailian X podcast over the weekend. According to the Hebrew Bible, King Solomon was renowned for his great wisdom and wealth, and his many building projects included a temple in Jerusalem lavishly appointed with gold and bronze objects. Such a structure would have required large amounts of metal from industrial-scale mining operations somewhere in the Middle East, but the scriptures are silent as to their location. Now, in the 1930s, the American archaeologist Nelson Glick announced that he had found the famous mines. Glick said while he was exploring the copper-rich Araba Valley, a geological rift that stretches from the Dead Sea south to the Red Sea and straddles the border of modern Israel, that he found this. Well, there have long been a lot of theories about this, and the search has continued for the alleged mines of King Solomon. I think there was an episode of In Search Of that was about this many, many moons ago. But now, we may have new evidence. And Matt, it all comes down to, you guessed it, manure. Because
Doesn't it always come down
to manure. Yes, yes.
Really, that's just the base level of everything.
Well, the Scottish part of me, if I'm to come out and be Scottish and tell about my heritage, the Stuart clan from Scotland, we have a somewhat bleak outlook on life, you know, at times, but in that sense that life is essentially manure, sometimes good things come out of it, just at the most unusual and awkward and weird times. That said, archaeologists discovered the 3,000-year-old dung, okay, preserved for millennia by the arid climate of Israel's Timna Valley. And this is adding fresh fuel to a long simmering debate about the biblical King Solomon and the source of his legendary wealth. You see, this area is dotted with copper mines and smelting camps. That much is known. And these are sites where the ore was heated and then turned into metal. A University of Tel Aviv archaeologist Erez Ben Yosef began excavating this site in 2013, this reported by National Geographic. And last year, he and his team were uncovering the remains of several walled structures that included a fortified gate, when suddenly they discovered what appeared to be animal excrement of relatively recent origin. Who knew that the stuff, well, of critters might actually tell us such things about the past? He said, we thought maybe some nomads had camped there with their goats a few decades ago, but the radiocarbon dates come back from the lab and bingo, boom, boom, shakalaka-laka. They confirm we were talking about donkeys and other livestock from the 10th century BC. It was hard to believe. Now, while the dung's extreme age and extraordinary condition were stunning, the implications of the radiocarbon results were even more jarring. They said that until we started the project in 2013, this was considered to be a late Bronze Age site related to the New Kingdom of Egypt in the 13th and early 12th centuries BC. There's clear evidence of an Egyptian presence during these centuries, and modern-day visitors to nearby Timna Valley Park are greeted by signs depicting ancient Egyptians. But the high-precision radiocarbon dating of this dung, as well as the textiles and other organic material, did show that the mining camp's heyday would have been in the 10th century BC, and that is the era of the biblical kings David and, yes, Solomon. That's interesting. So, who knows, maybe we will be unraveling soon another ancient mystery, and by the most innocuous of substances to be left behind, as those of ancient times passed through that region, that's right, and let their donkeys sleep, lie, and, well, defecate. I couldn't make this stuff up, folks. Truth is stranger than fiction. When we come back here in a moment, I want to feature a quick segment with my pal Mike. We're going to talk to you about a little adventure that I'm going to be going on later this year. I hope many of you can tag along, because you know how it is. When you're the doctor, you go spinning through time and space. You need companions, right? We'll be back right after this. It is the Grailian Report.
is the Grinlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinlian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRAradio.com. Be sure and check out the new listener lounge right there. It's just KGRAradio.com/chat. Matt will be in there. Matt in the chat, moderating like a boss. I'm going to make you the minister of moderation now.
Oh, man. I'll just add that to the list, won't I?
Yeah. He's just racking up all these ministries that he's in charge of. Hey, you know what? If you guys want to become part of the ordained, you can make your way down into the depths below. Archaic traditions since time immemorial have carried out their ordinations in caves, and if you make your way down into the heart of the Hollow Earth, eventually you will find your way to a light in the darkness known as Grailian X, where you can sign up. It's easy to do, fun, and it's only $7 a month. That's GrailianReport.com/X. You'll get the additional edition every week, and of course, the monthly Grailian Enigmas. What a bargain. Cheap. Lots of fun, too. Mike Migliori is going to join us here in just a second to discuss one of my traveling adventures that I'll be engaging on later this year. No, I don't use the TARDIS for that one. I mean, I always use the TARDIS, but you know, it's a cruise ship, so it's a little different. But I want to get to some listener emails first, because we had to skip those last week, and I do like to hear from you guys. Steve writes, Micah, listening to the Grailian Report podcast yesterday, and I heard the strange noise in Nottingham, and being a Nottinghamshire lad born and bred, the unexplained noise is, in my opinion, a two-tone train horn. These things work off of compressed air, and the compressor sounds faulty, hence the weird sound. Also, coincidentally, the massive Toton rail yard is just outside the city. Love the show. Keep up the excellent work. Yours, not Robin the Hood, but Steve. Hey, thank you, Steve. And, you know, we had hoped it would be a train as well, so I'm glad to know that you are of similar mind to us here in the bunker. Paul writes, Micah, dig the show. I'm surprised to hear you guys talk about the big black cats in the UK. Now, I have had three eyewitness encounters with big black cats. I grew up in the central Sierra Nevada mountains of California, however, from the 60s through the 80s. Now, each encounter was in the mountains and very close. He said they look like burnt stumps until they move or turn their head and you see those eyes. Boy, talk about eerie. Yeah. See, you think you're looking at like a stump and then boom, it moves. I mean, if I could count how many times that's happened to me when I'm out in the remote wilds. They were jet black, he says, very long tail, green or brown eyes. We've seen cougars many times, but the black cats, they look the same. I always figured some sort of cougar mutation or something like that. But I have heard and read stories of the Old West ranchers having encounters with big black cats claiming they were jaguars from South America. Keep up the good work. From one bunker to another, regards, Paul T. Glad to know you got your own bunker. That's cool. Sean writes, hey, Micah, I was just listening to the latest episode of the Grailian Report where you were discussing the Younger Dryas hypothesis. Now, being from Michigan, I've always been interested in its geology and the Great Lakes region in general. I've always wondered about the distinct circular ringed patterns of the different bedrock types in the center of Michigan's lower peninsula. And he sends along a link to Google Earth, or rather, I'm sorry, this was just a Google search terms result, but it was showing various different kind of geological maps and topographical maps and things that show the region in question. He says it looks a bit like a giant catcher's mitt, or perhaps for like a meteor. What do you think? Take care, my man. I'll be donating to Middle Theory again soon, hopefully to secure my coffee mug. Sean O'Neill, thank you for that, by the way, and thank you for your donates. We've got a bunch of those coffee mugs that I hope to get out this week. There's been a lot going on in the Ministry of Mugs. Actually, there is one here in the studio that Mr. Matthew is drinking his tea out of.
These things.
Yes, indeed. But the first big order that I'm going to be sending out is actually on its way right now. Eric writes, Noon Micah, have you seen this? I suspect that there's not much to it, especially given that I can't find any additional or newer info yet, but it's a moderately interesting story, and the pics, while not high quality and of course easily faked these days, sure make it look legit, though I'm curious as to why there aren't images of the purported elongated skull to go with the claw. And what was being reported, this was, of all things, MSN.com, reporting a giant claw, an alien claw found with warped skull in mystery tunnels deep below the Peruvian desert. Now, I'll just be clear, this was posted well before April 1st, so it wasn't an April Fool's Day report. But when I went to the link to try and read the article, Eric, I got to tell you, they had taken it down. Conspiracy? I don't know. You be the judge.
Must have been the aliens.
Must have been the aliens. It could have been the aliens. Might have been the aliens. Must have been the aliens. Yeah. So anyway, speaking of aliens again, that is a subject that comes up from time to time when we do our ancient mysteries cruise. Now, I've gone on a couple of these already, and the guy who does this is a good friend of mine and a fellow who joins us now on the Grayling Report, Mike Migliore. And first of all, I just want to say thanks for coming on the show and hope you're doing well.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And Mike, for those who don't know, why don't you tell us a little, what is an ancient mysteries cruise all about?
Well, it's all about joining like-minded people that are interested in ancient aliens, ancient alien theories and mysteries and things like that. We have a small group that will be on board, the Norwegian Breakaway, and we'll have private presentations on board during the days at sea from several guest speakers. We're thrilled to have you on our third one. And for this upcoming September 17th cruise, we are lucky enough to have Erik von Däniken as our featured guest speaker. I'm sure everyone knows who he is, but with his 40 books, 65 million books sold worldwide, he is the probably the person that started the ancient astronaut theories. So we've got him coming on board doing some private presentations and lectures for us. We also have Nick Redfern. I believe he's a friend of the Grayling Report as well.
Absolutely.
And he's been on numerous episodes of History Channel's Ancient Alien TV series. We also have John Ventry, who's coming with us. He has done several different TV shows and written a few books, and so it'll be interesting to get his take on some of these things. And again, backed by popular demand, we have yourself joining us.
And again, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed these in the past. Great to have some great guys. John Ventry, of course, also somebody I know there. You know, Mike, this, again, being the third cruise, what have you heard from people who have attended? What are the highlights that they tell you about?
Well, it's getting to interact and getting to know some of the speakers and meeting other people that have the same interest as they do. It's not just a weekend conference or a Saturday seminar where a couple of speakers get up and talk and everyone goes home. We're on board for a whole week. Our past passengers have said that, you know, having dinner with yourself or Nick Redfern or Erik von Däniken, how cool is that? Going to one of the bars or lounges on board and having a drink with the speakers and other people, that's what really makes the whole cruise. It's not only that, but we have a couple of shore excursions that are included, and our speakers join us. So we're going to be sailing around the Bermuda Islands, doing a sunset cruise, drinking rum Swizzlers while talking about ancient aliens and ancient astronauts and mysteries and Bermuda Triangle and Atlantis. And when you talk about this, you don't get that funny stare that you may get if you bring this up in other areas.
It's funny because, again, being what I consider in this community one of the token skeptics, even if I am talking with people who don't know about this sort of thing outside of it, I still get that strange sideways glance from time to time. And that is something that I love about these conferences, Mike, getting to be around people who kind of already have an idea about what you're talking about. And so you enter this almost with like a friendship already made. And the way that you meet these people, you get to know them. I've come away from these experiences often feeling like I've known many of them for much longer than just these cruises. So the shore excursions, you know, they're a lot of fun. And for me as a speaker, getting to know and hear what the guests think about all this, you know, it's wonderful feedback. And I do truly enjoy those interactions with everybody. And it's just such a laid back kind of a setting. That may be my favorite thing.
Exactly. You know, for this cruise, we're going to be sailing from New York City to Bermuda. We'll have a couple days at sea to start off. And in the morning and the afternoon, we'll have presentations by our outstanding speakers. But this is still a cruise ship. It's still a fun time. In the evenings, there's shows, there's entertainment, there's music, there's all kinds of things to do. And getting to know the different people in our group makes it all that much more fun. On our last cruise, we had people from Canada, Australia, Alaska, almost 22 different states where people had come from. And everyone loves to talk about, you know, ancient mysteries and things. And when someone you can talk to doesn't think we're nuts, it just makes it all that much more fun. You know, Mike, I'm sure you've got, you know, many listeners that download your Grayling Report, your podcast. Mm-hmm. Ancient Aliens has been around for 11 seasons. You know, I sit at home, I listen to the podcasts, I'm driving in my car listening to them, I'm watching the TV series, and I've got questions. I want to ask questions, and I want to get comments from these speakers as well. And then there's even a few times, you know, I believe some of these theories, but there's a few of them that are pretty far out there.
Yeah, sure.
So with having to being able to discuss this with other people that either have the same ideas or completely opposite, it just makes it that much more interesting. And you know, over the course of a week, to hear the speakers talk and what they really think about these subjects. And a couple of times in the past, we've had a couple of speakers that are on the opposite ends of things, and to hear them go back and forth is just fascinating to me.
Well, it's good, again, in a fun environment where we can have speakers do that. I've probably been one of the ones that would go back and forth, and but I like that because, again, I am a person who can respect somebody else's opinion, even if I have differences with them. And I think what we all share in common, especially, is a love for history. You know, Mike, getting back to the upcoming Ancient Mysteries cruise, we're headed to Bermuda this time, right?
That's correct. We're leaving out of New York City, right out of Manhattan. So we'll sail past the Statue of Liberty and all the towers in Manhattan. And then it's 2 days at sea, sailing on a beautiful ship. Again, as I mentioned, you know, the conference part and the seminars and lectures are great, but this is a big, giant, beautiful new cruise ship. 3,900 total passengers. Our group, of about 100 or so, will have private venues for the presentations and speakers. But, you know, sailing on the Norwegian Breakaway, all this time to explore the ship, explore different things on board. They've got 20-some restaurants on board and lounges and entertainment and Broadway shows. I believe the Rock of Ages is the dinner show or the entertainment for the evening, and several other different shows that are going on during the week there.
Wow. I tell you, that is just incredible. I got to tell you also, I mean, speaking to that idea about the onboard entertainment on that last cruise, not only do you have all these great shows, you've got magic shows. I mean, you've got musicals, you've got things like that. But there is also, me being a nature guy, there is the scenery. I mean, again, if you've never been on a cruise ship, the thing I love about it the most is being able to look out over the ocean, being able to stand out there on the top deck at night and watch the stars overhead. It's just a beautiful kind of an experience, I've really got to tell you. And those are as much for me a part of this entire experience. But then there's what goes on off the ship altogether. I mean, when you actually do these excursions and you get to visit these locations, and if you're like me, you may not handle heat very well, but of course you can always bring an umbrella along and just get out there and just have this adventure. It's just so much fun, Mike. So again, so with this cruise, we know that of course a cruise sometimes can be expensive. What does this one include?
That's one of the comments I do get, and they ask why they think our cruises cost more. But what I've learned over the years, I've been in the travel business for many, many years, and it seems that the cruise lines like to toss out a cheap price, and then when you get on there and you start adding all the extras and a little bit of this and a little bit here, a little bit there, it ends up to be a lot more than you expect. So what we've tried to do is include as much as possible so that there's no sticker shock at the end of the week. For our seven-night cruise, it includes, of course, the cruise with all your meals, all your entertainment. Our price includes all port charges, taxes, fees. We have a private cocktail reception with all of the speakers. The speakers will have dinner during the night, during the week, and we have a group of each night, a different group of people will be able to sit down and have dinner with our great speakers. We'll have a group photo taken, and of course, the two full shore excursions are included with us. For this cruise, we've got two evening cruises, and so you've got 2.5 days to explore Bermuda on your own. You can go to the beaches, you could do snorkeling, some scuba diving is available, you could tour the island. So there's plenty of time to get out and see the beautiful islands of Bermuda, as well as having a couple of shore excursions with our group and speakers as included with the price. And they've got a special right now, which they call their Free at Sea package. And if you pick an inside cabin, you get one choice. If you have ocean view or above, you can add a drink package that includes all your drinks for the week. You can include Wi-Fi. You can include a shore excursion credit. There's all kinds of extras that you can add to your cruise to really make it just about as all-inclusive as possible.
Yeah. The only thing I've got to work out now, Mike, is a way to get all my gear down there so we can do the live Graylian Report show from that cruise ship. That would be really neat. Any last thoughts on your end? Again, I mean, I just can't wait. It's going to be another fun time. The adventure, all the new people that you meet, the speakers, you know, the ideas, the dinners, and the views. So really, anything else that you'd like to add to wrap up?
Well, this is our third time. We've had a pretty good response over the past couple of cruises. This one seems to be going very well. We don't have a whole lot of cabins left. We've only got about 15, maybe 16 cabins left.
Oh, wow.
So if you're interested, please go to our website. It's www.ancientaliencruise.com. And all the information is on there. There's a reservation form if you'd like. Or you can actually give us a call toll-free at 877-642-4308. You know, give me a call. Glad to go over anything with you, answer any questions, help you pick up the right cabin. We can even talk about your favorite episode of Ancient Aliens or what the top five Graylian Report podcasts are.
Excellent. And of course, you very well may see Mike Migliore and I enjoying a cocktail together somewhere there aboard. Mike, my brother, always good to talk to you. Give my very best to your lovely wife, Wendy, and I am looking forward to setting sail with you this September on the Ancient Mysteries cruise.
Great. Thanks very much.
Always good to hear from you, Mike, and yeah, that's going to be a good time. I mean, really just going to be a fun little adventure. Always is, though, right? When you get out and you meet people and you do incredible things, you know, spending time. I mean, we've talked plenty about it but when we went down to Belize, you know, some of the experiences. And I'll just tell you this, too, that one of the most meaningful things that happened for me on that trip was, this is last September, one of the young couples, Neil and Jamie, who often listen to the program, so they're probably listening now. And if so, hello out there, and I hope you guys are doing good, my dear traveling companions. And they told this incredible spiritual experience that they had, which I've talked about a little, and I still want to get Neil and Jamie maybe to just come on and talk about that. You know, there are certainly experiences I think that you have sometimes that make you question whether you're of the most rational mind or whether you are someone, you know, who seeks that higher self and how to access that and how to become, you know, part of something greater, and to, you know, renew and enrich your relationships with those who you care the most about. You know, these are part of those experiences, and you meet people, like I say. I love it when I go to these conferences and events and things, and I meet people who, again, there's this instant connection, and you feel like you've known them your whole life, or maybe all your lives, all your regenerations, in my case. Speaking of the spiritual, just changing gears here for a second, there was a story that was featured in the British tabloids. But, you know, from time to time, there is a photo that accompanies them, and it does at least get me thinking about what may or may not be. What they were reporting, and I'll read a little from this article. They'd said, you know, spook hunters claim to have caught on camera a ghostly friar. Friar Took, perhaps, who haunts a 17th century pub. Now, legend has it that the merry monk in Bishop Auckland, County Durham, has played host to the ghoul for generations, and now experts insist they finally pictured him in the boozer's cellar. So he was a merry monk, and now we know why.
If you're going to haunt somewhere, why not make it a pub?
Or the boozer cellar in the
pub.
Yeah,
the boozer cellar.
I've been fascinated. I mean, there are so many pubs that have this kind of a story appended to them. And next time I get over across the pond, I want to visit some of those. I love traveling. I've got to get back out there. You know, that's one great thing about podcasting, Matt, is you can just disappear and just take your work with you. I just want to disappear for a while. I just want to go and travel.
You're just going to leave me here in the bunker, I suppose.
I have a TARDIS. You can come along.
Hey, you know, I'd like to go on that cruise.
Yeah, well, maybe you can come on the cruise too. Yeah, I need traveling companions when I go out and do this stuff. They're the ones that help me see it. I've seen it all so many times, and yet I'm still mystified by the smallest little blooming flower. But anyway, I'm getting like really metaphysical tonight. Anyway, so Elaine Kelly, and this is one of the representatives of what are called the Spectre Detectors. They're ghost investigators there in the area. And they said, almost as soon as we got in there, a wooden cross was thrown from the mantelpiece across the room. We went into the cellar, and there were also a lot of hot and cold spots, and it was highly unusual, they said, to have hot spots in a stone room. They said that we felt a burning sensation. One of the people said that they felt it on their face. They said one photo taken during the evening shows what they insist is the friar's face staring out of the darkness. And Elaine added, according to legend, a monk who roamed there was flogged and burned at the stake. And I think that was why I got that sensation. The photo that accompanied the article, again, I got to say, did you see it?
Yeah, I did.
It did look like a face.
It did. But it's a little obscured, but...
Well, I'd say it also didn't look like a monk, though. It looked like he was wearing like a priest's collar to me.
Yeah.
And that wasn't a monk. I don't know. There were some really good photos. Jim Harold and I, on our paranormal report that we did back in the day, it was, you know, the video podcast, we had received a photograph from a guy in Virginia that showed these two little wisps of what looked like smoke over these two individual graves in this old 19th century graveyard. But what was really interesting about these pictures is that he had been using like a stereoscopic camera that took two separate photos from slightly different angles. Both of the actual images, both of the cameras that took these images showed these strange wisps hovering in front of these graves. And it was such an unusual, it was just weird. I remember I wrote an article about it, and the site that published the article had actually taken it down and said, you know, we're just not interested in spooky stuff right now. And I was like, are you kidding? This to me is like one of the most, the very most, if not the most convincing ghost picture that I've ever seen. Again, you know, I'm on the fence about that, but some of those pictures do fascinate me. And do you remember when I was younger, you too, Matt, we would from time to time go, you know, masquerading around the countryside, carrying sometimes film cameras.
Yeah.
Taking pictures. I've got a weird picture. There's the famous story associated with Helen's Bridge. Okay. And one night I was up there and somebody was using some goofy looking dorky detector that had like an antenna, and the antenna started, you know, picking up all kinds of little transient anomalies and all kinds of stuff. And I lifted my little 35 millimeter camera and took a picture of Helen's Bridge. And there was this strange arc of light just shooting directly across. Now, you know, that could have been a lot of things. Although the exposure setting that I had and also the shutter speed should not have caused a long exposure kind of an effect where something akin to a rod appeared where if an insect was flying across, I don't know. It could have been nothing, probably an insect. I just remember I used to be interested in that kind of stuff. And I think my love of photography honestly goes back a little, you know, even further, really, than just, you know, interest in ghosts and things like that. I may be less interested now, but at one time I used to carry around my 35 millimeter photographer handbook because I used to think, hey, if you're going to get stuff like that on film, it's going to be with an analog camera, an old, you know, before they had the digital guys. But see, my dad, he's into 35 millimeter film development, and he loves to do the old school film photography stuff. And he'll scan his pictures and he'll print them at home. But recently his printer finally bit the dust. Did you hear about this?
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised, though, that you hadn't heard about this, because every time this happens, he calls me and says, come over here and fix this printer or fix this computer or fix whatever it is. He wanted to come down here into the bunker and use our... Look at our printer. We need a new printer.
Yeah, it's getting old.
We're going to have to get a new printer. Well, see, he wants to buy a new printer, but his problem is that, you know, the one that he bought was almost $400. And I get it. Nobody wants to have to spend that much, especially like right around tax time. But then again, you know, I know a lot of people who are getting tax returns right now. And let me tell you, you don't have to spend $400 to get a good printer. In fact, I think some of the best printers on the market probably cost less than $100 right now. You may want to know why I'm interested in this. That's right. Of course, here's why. I was on a call with a sales rep from Dell recently. And they, you know, again, I need to buy a new printer because I've had problems with mine for years. But printers can be extremely expensive. And the biggest problem that I always encounter is, I actually had this happen one time. I went online to one of these sites and I bought the toner cartridge. It was ridiculous. It was like $65 or $70. Yeah. Have you had to buy one?
Oh yeah, they get up there.
It's awful. And so I buy this thing, I get it home, and it doesn't work. And so I go through the instructions and I try to install this thing. It does not work. So I'm on this call the other day and they said, see, this is the number one problem that people have with printers these days, is that they will buy a printer. They'll spend enough money on the printer, but then they have to continue to buy the toner cartridges and the ink. And that is always what the problem is. And they said, really, right now, Dell is offering a lot of good printers. What you used to have to pay $400 for, you can get for $100. A lot of those start at $50. And the thing is that you don't have to replace the ink constantly, which is very important to me because I've spent a lot of money over the years. I mean, you got to keep in mind, I'm an author. So during this call, you know, here's what they told me that they would be willing to do. And I think this is important because, again, not only do I need a printer, but now I've got to try and get one from my dad. We did the research. We found out that, again, these are some of the best and some of the most cost-effective on the market right now. And for 1 week only, they said, we will actually allow you, that is Graylian Report listeners, you guys, to get a printer that's not only low cost, but you can take 40% off that cost and add free shipping to that. All you got to do is just go to dell.com/TGR40. That's dell.com/TGR, like the Graylian Report, 40. So I figured if I'm going to, I might as well get a few of you guys too. Might even get Dad to do that as well. But again, you're going to get a top-of-the-line printer that you didn't know that you could probably afford, and also that's for half off. And again, this is the thing about like what Dad does. See, some of the most cost-efficient printers these days can do what he likes to do. They print quality, you know, full-color photos from your computer, and that's what he wants to do with his printer. It's like having a little photo lab in your spare bedroom or your, well, your bunker if you're like me, or wherever you want to put it. So do check it out, dell.com/TGR40. Who knows? You might find a ghost photo. You might even be able to take a photo of something, print it off, and send a copy to me. We get a lot of those from time to time. That is true. We do get a lot of people who send along things. In fact, I do want to pay a quick mention to somebody here when we come back from this break, and then we're going to get into our mastermind segment, because from time to time, fellow 4TNs out there in the world abroad, they will send me information about projects that they're involved with. Sometimes they send along photos. If you're somebody like that and you would like to do that, or if you'd just like to send along an email, info@micahanks.com, info@graylianreport.com. That's the way to do it. We'll keep it that simple. We'll be back, Matt and I, and Mr. Hobbo on the Graylian Report. Back it is, the Graylian Report. We're about to enter the Mind Palace. No, seriously, this is something that really fascinates me. I do want to give a quick shout out to my pal Ben. He had sent along some awesome fan art. Matt, you saw that?
Yeah.
Some Stranger Things inspired fan art, but he had asked if I might possibly give a shout out to one of his groups. He's got a group called 401 Files. They have a Twitter and an Instagram page, so if you go online, you'll be looking for 401 Files. He says they discuss all topics considered fringe, extraterrestrials, Bigfoot, UFOs, that kind of stuff. So if you're interested, you might check out 401 Files that Ben's doing there in the UK. Good stuff indeed. Speaking of good stuff coming out of the UK again, I think my all-time favorite, well, I don't know, it's hard to say. I love English culture, and of course, the Doctor is a particular archetype that resonates with me, but so is Sherlock Holmes. And the Telegraph was talking recently about the idea of a mind palace, or as some call it, a memory palace. Are you familiar with this, what this means?
I wasn't until I saw the story, and I wanted to actually ask you, you being a little bit more familiar with the books, does it kind of go into any of this stuff, or is this just...
Well, the general idea is, yeah, that Sherlock Holmes, the fictional detective, did he would close his mind, and he would have this mind palace that he could go into where he would be able to access information. You know, the mind does function a lot like a computer, and there are a variety of ways that people are able to access information, but the Telegraph reports on this, and they say, you know, visualizing items you wish to remember by placing them in particular locations within a building familiar to you, in your mind, okay, let me be clear, you're pretending that you're walking around in a building, your own home perhaps, and memories that you want to be able to relocate, you are placing in locations throughout the home, okay? This is a mind technique supposedly first created in the 5th century BC, but today it's routinely used by many individuals regarded as memory champions, from chess masters to pub quizzers. I wonder if Garry Kasparov, the famous Russian chess player, has managed to do that. Now, the Telegraph reports that fresh evidence of the memory-boosting qualities of this technique were presented earlier last month in the journal Neuron. Martin Dresler and his colleagues from Radboud University in the Netherlands had showed that after practicing the technique for half an hour every day for a period of 40 days, that participants dramatically improved their ability to remember a list of 72 random nouns. An average of 26 items recalled before training rose to 62 thereafter. Now, this is an impressive finding. However, it's not clear how practical the memory palace is for helping you remember the things that make your day-to-day living run smoothly. For example, where you parked your car in the multi-story or the time that your next dental appointment may be. See, first, this technique requires you to call up and visualize a building that you know well so that you can walk through it confidently. This isn't easy for everyone, and actually it isn't even necessary. Eric Legge and colleagues at the University of Alberta showed this when they gave lists of unrelated words to two groups of participants. They asked one group to imagine a familiar building for their memory palace, whereas they asked the second group simply to work with a computer-generated structure. And here's what they found. The two groups performed equally well, but better than the control group. It may be that focusing our full attention on each item is the crucial factor rather than where in the building we place it. But see, I've never ever thought of like a mind palace or a mental palace as being an actual building that I walk around in. Ways that I've been able to remember things a lot better, Matt, for instance, include I will carry a notepad around. I usually have two or three of them. Here's the one that I have right here. My studio is full of them. I've got a whole desk drawer full of notepads, and I keep a notepad usually on me at all times. And a lot of people, the most intelligent people and people gifted with real incredible memory, they'll do the same thing. They'll keep a little notepad that they can put in their front pocket or in their, you know, back pocket for that matter, and carry that around, and they'll write notes down. And you don't even have to do that anymore. These days, you can just use an iPhone. Well, I use my iPhone, and I'll just have a, you know, like a notepad or something, you know, open on my iPhone, and I'll keep tabs of things. Like, for instance, if I'm in a large group of people who I've never met before and I want to remember their names, as I meet them and I'm introduced, I'll just make a quick note and write down their names. I've read certain studies that say that if you write something down, that you may be up to 80 to 90% more likely to remember it than if you just tried to remember it with your memory alone. And I know that when I write down a name, and it helps too to kind of not only write it down, but say it also. Yeah, or say it back to yourself, or even sometimes say, oh, you know, your name's John. John, kind of like my cousin John, or something like that. That also helps. And I have found that I can remember, 90 to 100 people's names. Yeah. The Telegraph article gave a good breakdown about what keeps memory healthy, and there are a number of factors that they link to this. Good sleep is important. In fact, this is an important part of how we consolidate our memories. So you skimp on sleep, and your memory will suffer. But you also have to be able to eat well. A healthy diet gives your brain the resources it needs to work. You've got to practice building your memory, too. And then competition. They say test yourself against friends and family. When you're competing, all your senses are alert. But there is such a thing as hyperthymesia, okay, which is a condition some people possess. And this is where it comes down to people who want to practice at memory and improve that versus people who just seemingly are born with it. And some even are, again, they are diagnosed with a condition, hyperthymesia, a condition of possessing an extremely detailed autobiographical memory. People with hyperthymesia remember an abnormal, according to studies, an abnormally vast number of their life experiences. But see, I remember once I was dating a girl one time, and I wanted to like remember all of these experiences that we had had. And so I remember I went up into the attic of my the parish house next to my father's church, and I was walking around in the attic. And I just started going back. I went back to when I first met her, and I went through all these memories. And I startled myself with all of the things that I could remember from the time that we'd known each other. And I think that, you know, if you challenge yourself to try and sit down, really focus, meditate, enter your mind, and go through and see what kinds of things you can remember, you would do the same. You would surprise yourself. There were American neurobiologists, Elizabeth Parker, Larry Cahill, and James McGall. They had identified two defining characteristics of the condition known as hyperthymesia. One is spending an excessive amount of time thinking about one's past, okay, and displaying an extraordinary ability to recall specific events from one's past. And that word hyperthymesia is from the ancient Greek, which just essentially means excessive remembering. I wonder if that's really a condition, though. Again, in this modern age, there are so many things that are called conditions, like it's a problem. You know, I think that, again, some of the most brilliant and gifted people throughout history have functioned a little different from the rest of us. But see, there are different kinds of these exceptional memory capacities that people can display and have displayed
throughout the years. Hyperthymesia is one, but we've got eidetic memory. We've got mnemonists. See, a mnemonic kind of device like that is what I was talking about, where you'll make an association.
Yeah.
You make that association, and then you can remember something. But you also have people who are savants. They may be socially awkward or in some ways kind of like Rain Man, you know, incapable of functioning, you know, in a normal capacity from day to day, but yet they possess this remarkable talent, an extraordinary ability. And then there's also what's called emotional memory, which is interesting. An emotional or flashbulb memory refers to the memory of a person's significant event with distinctly vivid and long-lasting detailed information. These events are usually shocking and with photographic quality. It's so fascinating to me, though. A flashbulb memory, sometimes as they're called, is said to be less accurate and less permanent than the photographic memories, but its forgetting curve is less affected by time in comparing to other types of memories. One important aspect of a flashbulb memory is that it involves emotional arousal when the event is being remembered, and therefore this kind of memory does not have to be accurate, and the accuracy usually decreases during the first 3 months and goes up again at about 12 months. Matt, you remember? Do you remember when we did that episode where we focused on people who suddenly awaken from like a coma or an accident and they're speaking a different language?
Yeah, absolutely.
And in most of the cases that we looked at, rather than being someone who just suddenly wakes up and they're speaking a different language that they had never spoken before, I think in every case we looked at, those people had had at least some limited exposure to that language. But in their waking memory, they didn't go around saying, oh, well, you know, I remember speaking French, you know, mon et moi, a tatoujois, ma chérie. Thank you. Anyway, so, point is, you throw your hands up. I'm going to throw a pin at you, Matt.
Do it.
So, the, again, the people who were able to wake up and speak a new language, they had had exposure to that language earlier in life, which, again, suggests that there are perhaps subliminal factors or aspects of the less conscious, I don't want to say unconscious entirely, because obviously these things are traceable and they can be remembered, per se. But again, it sometimes takes trauma or some sort of something similar to a trauma or some sort of an emotional kind of trauma. That might be a kind of trauma too, which elicits this or withdraws this memory from the subconscious mind and allows this to become full, vivid, and something that is actuated, especially in the case of those who wake up from an accident speaking this language that they didn't think they could speak, but that they had been exposed to early in life. And the impression that I get is that our minds have this infinite capacity, and that's why I talk about this pretty, you know, frequently on this show. We periodically address the weird things that people seem to be able to do when they're under stress or when they've gone through some sort of a trauma or if they've been in an accident. The question I have is, if these things can be learned or if these things can be stored, and without having to be learned, they can be retrieved when there is a sudden need for it, how do you override that and access these memories without there having to be the trauma? You know, in other words, there is something going on in our minds that we can't in the everyday just fully access. See, people like me are considered weird because I sit around and I think all day, or I don't just sit and think, but I mean everywhere I'm going, if I'm driving, if I'm in the shower, if I'm in the, you know, the library, or if I'm in the grocery store, I mean, I'm thinking about things. And a lot of people are just like, let me just peace out and put on a show and just, I want to watch TV. I have to turn off the TV at night because I can't stop thinking long enough to focus on the show that I'm watching or trying to watch or failing to watch.
Oh, that happens to me all the time, like listening to the radio and or a podcast or something, having to run it back and be like, I totally was not listening to a word.
it's true. I remember the worst instance of this ever was I was leaving Nashville and I was driving up to Kentucky to visit Tiffany Mack. And I had a podcast on and I couldn't have told you what I had listened to because, I mean, I just had so many other things going on. And plus, I mean, all of the landmarks on the way, you know, there's Mammoth Cave and all this stuff on that stretch of highway. And I just had so much on my mind. I was not paying attention to what was on that podcast. But it's fascinating to me, again, because how do you access all that you've experienced, all that you've seen, all that you've learned, and all that you've been exposed to, and that under very unusual circumstances can apparently be proven to have been retained and then recalled, but that in your everyday waking life, you aren't able to do that. That fascinates me. And, you know, neuroscience is trying to solve these kinds of things to understand people who have incredible memory. See, again, the savant syndrome is something that's very similar to this. You know, one of the most well-known cases involved a savant memory instance of a person called Kim Peek, okay? And this was the very guy that the film Rain Man was based on. But anyway, Peek was a reported savant. His ability to remember most information, they said, just was, I mean, incredible. They said he was able to memorize large pieces of information from the age of just 16 months. And that's another thing, too, by the way. People with really good memory tend to remember early in their life. But people like this, people like Kim Peek, the guy upon whom Rain Man was based, they have these incredible abilities, not only to remember, but just, I mean, to be able to kind of like, how do you put it? I mean, look at like what Rain Man did. He could apply it as well. And when you can take an incredible ability to recall and retain information, then apply that to everything that you see, that's essentially how Sherlock Holmes worked. Not that he couldn't actually solve the puzzles and piece things together. He used, of course, the science of deduction, but the fictional Sherlock Holmes, in addition to that, had this incredible ability to recall all of the different kinds of crimes that had been committed throughout England's history. And thereby, when he was on the scene of a crime, he could spot certain things that he recognized from his memory, the mental memory, which in that instance is very much this kind of a mental palace that revolves around memory and not so much just being able to see a pattern and put the pieces together and solve the crime. He knew certain things to anticipate because he had such a familiarity with the history of crime. So how does one remember like that? This is another one that fascinates me too. And although it doesn't necessarily fall into the realm of memory per se, I think it's of equal interest. People who are able to speed read, but some people are capable of not just speed reading. It's said that Abraham Lincoln, U.S. president, had been able to actually read a book this quickly. He could take it, he could look at the first page, then he would turn, look at the second page, then he would turn, look at the third page, and he could read a book that quickly. And the reason why is they said that he had such a photographic memory that he could look at a page and recall the information on that page from merely looking at it for a second or two, then look at the next page, and he could take in a book that quickly. And I was telling that story to somebody recently, and they said, oh, my mom used to do that. My mom could look at the page of a book, and then she would be able to summarize everything that was on that from just looking at it. And I had this unusual conversation with somebody at a conference a number of years ago, and she said that the U.S. Air Force had done a similar thing where they were trying to train Air Force pilots to try and see not just in their direct line of sight and what they were looking at, but to see with their whole eye. I mean, think about this. Listening at home right now, you can look directly ahead and you can be looking at something. Look at a picture on the wall or look at, you know, something on the counter or look at something on the television. But now stop looking at just what you're actually focusing on. See with your whole eye. I can be looking directly ahead. I can be looking across the console at Matt, but I can see a window and a door, and I can see into the next room, and I can see a tunnel that we really need to actually get that shaft, and we need to try and winterize that, even though it's always clammy and cool down here in the bunker, but you know what I mean. It just weirds me out, that empty chasm over there and that cave wall. You know, I can see a box sitting over there. I can see way over here a musical instrument. I mean, you have this peripheral vision, but nobody uses their peripheral vision. But what if you could completely see everything that your eye is capable of perceiving apart from just your direct line of sight that you are focusing on? Imagine about this, you know, this weird idea of, you know, your mind-body connection. What if utilizing the full function of something like your eye, you could access different parts of your mind too? You begin to interpret information differently. I mean, some people would call this, you know, mind hacks or biohacks and things like that. But again, to me, it's all a matter of, you know, how can you learn to do more with what you have? Obviously, the human body has capacities well beyond what we generally make use of in the everyday. And if we could only use the full spectrum of human potential, the full range of abilities at our disposal, imagine what humans would be capable of. I mean, we'd be like mutants. We'll be right back.
I was just in the mood for this song, man. I'm trying to get out of that rut.
I love this tune.
Yeah, exactly.
I love this whole, you know, EP.
All right, that's enough of that. We haven't got time to talk about that. So, seriously. Anyway, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to be mean to Matthew, the Grayling Reverend. So, again, you know, I mean, as we're kind of wrapping things up here, I guess just the kind of final thoughts. Well, first I wanted to ask you, Matthew, I mean, have you ever employed some of those kinds of little memory tricks to improve your natural ability to remember things or to access information about memories you may not have known that you had?
I have not. Going over a lot of this memory stuff myself, it's funny. I wouldn't ever say I have an ability to speed read or anything like that. But depending on the content, I'm able to pick information up really quick and go through a book very fast and be able to summarize it and remember even very specific key points.
There are certain times where I'm able to do that. I mean, there are certain times where I can take a book and I can almost get the majority of the information from the book as though by osmosis.
Yeah.
And that's why I've often wondered, wouldn't it be great, I mean, for researchers, because if you sit and you read a book, the important thing to remember is that unless you're one of these savants or that you have this incredible ability, you won't remember the majority of that information. And so the important thing to do is to be able to remember the most relevant information from that book, not just a synopsis, but I mean, you know, the key useful points, especially if we're talking about nonfiction. And so I've often said, yeah, wouldn't it be great if rather than just like a Cliff Notes version of a book, you could access a website that gave you that synopsis of everything. You know, here are a lot of people. Not a lot, but I mean, there have been at least a good number of people who have had super memory over the years. Bob Petrella was one, Los Angeles-based producer for the Tennis Channel, and they say Bob may remember every number in his cell phone. But that's not all. He said he apparently has an ability to recall sporting events. Okay, they say give him a date like March 30th, 1981, and he could tell you not only that it was the day Reagan was shot, but also that Indiana beat North Carolina for the NCAA championship that evening. And they say when it comes to the Pittsburgh Steelers, his favorite team, you can show him a single freeze frame from most any game that he's ever seen, and he can tell you not only the date of the game, but the final score. Isn't that crazy? Jill Price also, probably the best known person who has this kind of an ability, and has described her ability as a gift, as well as a nonstop, uncontrollable, and totally exhausting one. She was the first person to be diagnosed with the condition and recently published a memoir called The Woman Who Can't Forget. Price remembers most details of nearly every day she's been alive since she was 14 and compares her super memory to walking around with a video camera on her shoulder. If you throw a date at me, it's as if I pulled a videotape out, put in a VCR, and just watched it that very same day. Could you imagine living like that? And like Bob Petrella, Price calls California home, though working as an assistant at a Jewish religious day school. She's about as far from Hollywood as you can get, and although people she meet will meet at parties and things are impressed with your ability, once you can remember everything from the date of the Lockerbie plane bombing to the last episode of Dallas, in her memoir she apparently wrote, and she describes super memory as being a kind of a nuisance, partly because she can't seem to forget painful events in her life, like when someone she had a crush on rejected her. Of course, rejection is merely a part of the game of love, and love one small part of the broader game that is life. And those memories, the good and the bad, are all part of what makes us who we are. That'll be the final word this week as far as memories go. But remember, of course, to check us out online at graylianreport.com and follow us at graylianreport if you so choose, so that you can keep up with us throughout the week. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley and I, Rayson Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrail, Tiffany Mack, and of course, yours truly. I remain your doctor here in the dark heart of the hollow earth. I am Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. We will catch you guys all next week right here in your favorite place beyond the fringe. And until next time, as always, my friends, stay strange out there.
Been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.